The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Why are so many people on this bandwagon? Why do they lack vision? Why have they become short-term in their thinking? Why do they not care about long-term returns? It's just about what you've done for me. It's growth at any cost, which we've done through the debt markets. We're willing to proliferate the bad, even if that means enslaving our children, our grandchildren, under a burden of debt.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, I'm not much of a TV guy. You know, I like to read if I've got time to do anything. But when I come home and my mind is fried, my wife knows that I can go downstairs, I can turn on the Western Channel, and I know who the good guys are. I know who the bad guys are. And even if there is a surprise, one between the other, they've tipped the hat. You know, the bad guy pretending to be the good guy might actually have had a black hat the whole time tipping him off. And so, you know, there is something about the length and the rhythm of a Western versus what we have today, which just is coming at us, you know, at light speed.
Good and bad is becoming more ambiguous, and it didn't used to be.
That's true.
So my kids had never seen any of the spaghetti Westerns. You go back to the 1970s, and Clint Eastwood was a star in many of them, quite a bit younger then. You've got the music of Ennio Morricone, you know, setting the dramatic atmosphere. And that's what you had for the bad guys, the less than bad guys, the occasional good guy, and their cattle rustling and their bank robbing and their card playing and their whiskey drinking and gunfighting and, you know, then the cold nights by the fire. And all of them are sort of figures of solitude grasping to survive in a very harsh world. And I maybe that's why it hasn't been in the Friday evening pizza movie and root beer float entourage. With family entertainment, it kind of is.
Well, and look at the superhero movie of today. It's just continual noise, sounds, movement, action. It's very, very different than the, like I was mentioning, the rhythm of a Western.
Well,
you have to take the time.
Or lack thereof. I mean, what's amazing to me is how long a scene could be extended, and even more amazing how an audience used to willingly sit with it. There was no computer graphics. There wasn't 1,000 special effects to stimulate the brain on a moment-by-moment basis. You really had to kind of... There was quiet moments. You were out on the plane.
You stuck with it. I'm going to have to teach you that, Dave. If you haven't, if you're not watching spaghetti Westerns, I don't know what the problem is.
Well, we did watch one, and Mary Catherine was surprised. She was like, how long is this movie? 3.5 It was a long movie. But it reminded me that attention spans have shrunk dramatically. Mm. And with that, there's been a change in the way that information is consumed, a change in our educational process. And in the final analysis, what has changed is the way we make decisions and what we consider reasonable time horizons. We've got short-termism. That's something that I referenced last week in our conversation, and that was in the corporate world or the corner offices and in the executive domain. Yes, you have higher turnover, shorter stints by executive leadership, and that's become sort of the norm at many an organization.
Life is like drinking out of a fire hose these days, it seems. It seems that you just don't have much time to take time to concentrate.
Well, investors, too, have shifted from years of holding companies as an investor to months or to days or to hours, and you even have the high-frequency traders, those firms which are in and out in seconds, and their compensation is not from an investment thesis and owning a certain value proposition, but they're interested in the rebates, which exchanges pay them to send order flow to that exchange rather than, again, some sort of inherent value proposition.
You know, it reminds me of interest rates. People used to pay interest rates. You know, you'd loan money out for time and interest would come back. And at this point, money's free. There is no interest paid. There's been a change, hasn't there? It's like stocks. Trading stocks now is about the rebate.
That's right. So as eye-popping results have sort of caught the imagination of investors, you've got strategy and plan and process. All of these things become secondary to chasing a return or chasing a yield, what little there may be. In the final analysis, chasing the dream of getting more money in a shorter time frame. That's returns. while at the same time neglecting the implicit cost of that pursuit, which is ignoring risks.
Well, and when people watch their neighbors or people that they know, family members, shifting what their priorities are and actually looking like they're winning, right? Charlie Sheen winning. They look like they're winning with shorter term types of things. I wonder if it's not fear of missing out.
Get me some of that. I want some of that. So, yeah, I mean, and you can wonder how lemmings run towards danger in the cliff's edge. And I do believe that in the mind of the lemmings, if you could go there, they just want what they think their neighbor has already discovered.
Right.
I mean, it's the blind leading the blind, unaware that there's sort of ignorance and hope and whatever that momentum is. As you speed the process, this mass movement of bodies towards the precipice.
And I wonder sometimes if what we think is good is actually good. You know, I look at the economy, Dave, and I think, well, you know, there's an awful lot of things that would say that it's in a growth mode, but it's costing us over $1 trillion a year of borrowing just by the government to make it look this way.
Yeah, and there is good, all right? We certainly have employment low, wages growing, but if we borrow from that Clint Eastwood classic, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, the good is not actually what it seems. Because, you know, on the face of it, you've got prices which are high, you've got investor bullishness which is at or near to record levels. For those who look from a more historical perspective, you look at the difference between bulls and bears, and if the differential is 40 points, you know that you're in sort of the excessive part of the market cycle. You're at the end of the market cycle. And so bullishness is a great thing, but it also is a hallmark of kind of as good as it gets, right? So there is good, but the mood has been set by something unhealthy, by something unstable. You might even describe it as bad.
So it might be the black hat, actually, that's tipping off that in the end of the movie, maybe 3.5 hours down the way, you find out that the guy people thought was good was actually the bad guy.
You know, I was fascinated. This last week, we had some earnings come out from financials, and, you know, JP Morgan kind of knocks the cover off the ball, and it's fixed income trading. They increased their profits from fixed income trading, but did not increase profits in lending. And I thought to myself, well, that's interesting. A bank that's making less and less money from lending and more money from trading debt. That's just a fascinating commentary in itself. So, but underlying the good, the bad is this debt. So we have the apparent good. But in this case, it's on top of a mountain of debt, which continues to grow.
Well, look at the university that you actually went to. I mean, you went to Oxford for a while. They're borrowing with 100-year bonds,
and they
Dave.
They did that a couple years ago. 2017 was the first issue. They're back to the market, and they're kind of tacking on hundreds of millions. They may even slip into the billions of new debt. And what's fascinating is it's not only 100-year paper, but it's between 2.5% and 2.75% interest, which is nothing over a 100-year period, right? But it's not secured either. So not only does it ignore the possibilities of inflation over a 100-year period, but it's also unsecured. It's just, hey, look, we've got hundreds of buildings and quite a history and reputation, and something should ever go wrong. Why wouldn't the British government bail us out after all? Or Oxford.
Right, right. And there's an insatiable appetite right now for that debt just because nobody can get interest anywhere.
Right. So record low rates, and you've got the ability of anyone, not just Oxford, but anyone to get any amount of money they want from the debt markets. I think of Spain, not exactly your best credit and not exactly the type of country that's been able to sort of contain inflation in the past. Same with Italy. But Spain's recent 10-year offerings was 5 times oversubscribed. Mm-hmm. We're talking about yields on 10-year paper of less than 1%, about 50 basis points, 0.5%. Italy, roughly 20 basis points, 4 times oversubscribed. People are crawling over each other to get less than 0.25% in interest.
Right.
Again, there's no compensation for inflation. And the notion that demand for any yield, it's a little bit crazy. Demand for any yield in a world of zero yields. And to me, that is creating an internal quote unquote market bad, if you will. So we've got the good, we've got the bad. Even though if you're judging things in terms of price action, the price of bonds has never been better. The price of stocks is perfect, right?
Well,
so judging by price action, this is actually very good and getting better.
I wonder if the ugly though, because you've pointed out the good, the bad, you're playing on this theme, right? The good, the bad, the ugly. Something that has become ugly that is distressing to me honestly. I try to roll with the punches, but in this particular area, it depresses me. The way people have become short-term, and they've given up disciplines that we know for thousands of years actually have worked. And, you know, our kids, when they were little, we used to watch a show, Riders in the Sky. It's a Western cowboy singing group. In fact, they come to Durango every once in a while, and they play at the Bar D, which is a chuck wagon that we have here in Durango. People who've been to Durango usually go. They ride the train. They go to the chuck wagon, and the Bar D Wranglers come. Ranger Doug, who's the key man in the group, he always tells the kids, you know, don't do it the easy way, do it the cowboy way. And so what they do is they show stories where you could do it the easy way, the quick way, like what we're talking about, this fear of missing out way, where you're a quarter of a point for interest, you're going to borrow money, really, for 100 years and take all the risks of Italy, Spain, Oxford, what have you, for just that little bit of gain. Well, that's not the old-fashioned discipline of buying something of value, something that you know will be there in the future, that you know will have value in the, you know, a higher value. Ranger Doug would say that would be the easy way, but it wouldn't be the cowboy way.
One of the things that comes up in our conversations very frequently when we're getting ready for these commentaries is a book you read a few years ago called Deep Work. And, you know, I will not do it justice. I have not read it. But the idea of slowing down, reflecting, focusing more on the quality of work versus the quantity, the quality of reading versus the quantity, limiting your inputs and quieting down your life a little bit. Again,
putting your phone on airplane mode on a Sunday. That's what I do every Sunday. I put it on airplane mode. You're not going to be able to reach me on a Sunday.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, but what he talks about, Dave, Cal Newport is the author, Deep Work. It's a good book. It's a good book. Very easy to read, but it sticks with you. One of the things he talks about is the way we think is being changed because of all the distractions. We can't think deep anymore. So we have to deliberately try to work on things that require concentration. You were talking about a movie that's 3.5 hours long. Now, I'm not going to say a movie's going to help you with deep work.
No.
But 3.5 hours with anything these days is almost an impossibility without an interruption.
Well, I want to make the case today that you sacrifice nothing in terms of returns on investment if you take a long-term view to growing wealth. And so the disciplines required to make that successful, those disciplines are difficult to maintain. And the strategies are easy. If you have a strategy, it's very easy to change mid-course when you appear to be out of step with, you know, perhaps a more obvious or accessible path to success. So, you know, the tyranny of the present, the tyranny of the urgent, you know, the tyranny of CNBC. There are many ways to succeed in making money. I'm not going to suggest that ours is the only way. It simply is one way that harnesses time.
But it requires patience.
Yeah. And time requires patience. It harnesses value, which requires a contrarian mindset, looking for the inexpensive, not the expensive, getting more expensive. And it requires consistency, which means that you're on a course for what seems like an eternity, and you willingly plod along. The basic elements of success in driving that approach are very easy to disregard because they're not easy to maintain. What is really not easy is maintaining ourselves.
Right.
It's not easy to maintain ourselves. We're often fickle. We're often fearful. We're often selfish. We're often short-sighted. So that theoretically, when we look at how we manage money, there's a mathematical touchdown.
Right.
We're going to talk about that. And it's easy to fumble, and it's not complete as the task and the method require some things. They require stability. They require commitment. Ideally, not just to a year or two, but through decades, not years, through generations, ideally. And I'll illustrate that. Not just your personal retirement time horizon.
Right. You know, I think about this concentration thing, Dave. You remember the movie, I think it was Pixar that put it out, Up. And there was this dog in the movie.
And Doug.
Dog. That's right. But he would see a squirrel, right?
We have Ranger Doug. Now we've got Doug the dog.
Now we've got, is it Doug the dog?
Oh, it's absolutely Doug.
You've got kids young enough to know. Okay, but remember when every time the dog sees a squirrel.
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 He's distracted.
And he's off. But we do that. We can say, all right, well, I'm going to be disciplined about this. And then we get disappointed about the returns. And we're like, well, wait a second. So-and-so's making money in the stock market. He's making money here. And we shift gears and forget the original plan. Squirrel.
You know, this weekend I ran a marathon and you got to run your own race.
Mm.
It's even more so the case in triathlon where you're bringing in three different disciplines and everybody's training at a different level. Some people do it professionally. Your age groupers, some are more competitive than others. Some are willing to sacrifice family and business time and whatever else. And others, I mean, you have to figure out how much time you're going to put in.
Who you are and who you're not.
Who you are, who you're not, what you're willing to give up in order to get whatever it is you want, right?
Right.
So you have to, in the end, run your own race.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's easy to get set on a particular course and then start worrying about everyone else around you. Somebody passes you and it drives me crazy.
Right.
Like, they passed me like I was standing still. Well, maybe they're on a different trajectory. Maybe they don't have a family and are willing to train 40 hours a week.
Right.
You know, there's different commitment levels, right? And I just think that issue of the fear of missing out and not running your own race and changing your disciplines mid-course, it does have a lot to do with looking around and by comparison being unsettled and not happy,
well,
not content with what you've got.
How often have you been passed by somebody that later you pass? And see, that's the thing too. We have to remember as we go through our lives, there are a number of people who look successful for a short period of time, so much so that we start getting nervous. It's like, well, maybe I'm missing something, that fear of missing out. And then later in the race, the guy's on the side of the road puking, okay,
right.
Because he overdid it. And you have to look back and go, okay, let's take it back to the markets. Quantitative analysis and all this high frequency trading and this and that. Well, is it really something in the long run wins?
Well, math is absolutely critical, but we're not quants. So meaning we're not trying or tying our methods to mathematical theorizing or algorithmic inference. Math is still the basis for what we believe is a very sound approach to intergenerational wealth management. So, I mean, shouldn't be a surprise there. Math and money are definitely related. But as I've discussed, going back to the book I wrote a few years ago, The Intentional Legacy, what we typically see is discussions and plans for resource management, they begin and end with tangible assets.
Real things, not promises.
Real estate, stocks, bonds, gold, what have you. And my bottom line argument in the book is that regardless of your worldview, I have one, it's clearly stated there, but regardless of what your worldview is or your baseline assumptions are about meaning and significance and purpose, effective management of your intangible resources are critical to your long-term success. That is a point that's often missed.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have all the money in the world and still be a moron when it comes to connecting with people and living skillfully in a broader sense. And that's where, again, the management of intangibles is just as important as the management of tangibles.
You know where that's tested, Dave? We've seen this through the years working with money. People who really have the intangibles down, when it comes time to divide that money up between siblings or move money a generation down, you've got families where it just destroys the family. We've had families literally see kids suing the parents. And then we've had many, many other occasions where the families have already worked everything out. They've had their family meetings. They may have quarterly family meetings, whatever it is, but they've worked out the intangibles before the tangibles get passed.
Right. Now, it's fascinating. I had a great conversation this last week, was honored to be a part of a family discussion. You know, the implications here for over 100 people, when you think of the grandparents, the kids who are on the line.
Isn't that amazing?
Great grandkids.
What an impact a family can have just in size.
And I'm heading out to Southern California in another couple of weeks to do the same thing, to sit with a family and discuss. These are very important things, but it's too often families facilitate something different. They facilitate kind of a selfish winner take all ethic, which pits siblings against each other. And again, sort of casts a vision of the future in only solipsistic terms. That is, the world revolves only around me. So, and I'm not saying this is purposeful. No parent sets out to design that. But if you don't practice something else, we and others are left to deal with our less good selves.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm getting at is that wealth is often destroyed by a mathematical function. I want to come back to math and intergenerational wealth management, the importance of math. But typically what we see is division, not only division of interests, but division of the money. And when you count the kids, you count the grandkids, you count the great grandkids and infuse self-interest. And self-interest is not bad, but it's a real variable nonetheless. You add all those people up and then divide the resource, you know, that's just normal. Dissipation is sort of the normal course for wealth. Division is the clearest mathematical function that gets you there, and it gets you there in a very short period of time.
So you have to counteract that. I mean, what's the opposite of division, Dave?
Multiplication. And obviously, multiplication is a way to solve for what could be described as sort of the family demographic conundrum.
Well, and something that you've talked about over and over, and actually we've practiced as a firm, at least the 33 years that I've been here, is ratios. Basically saying, okay, let's take two things of value that we know vary against each other. Gold and silver, platinum, palladium, Dow gold, you name it. And let's buy the thing that's cheap and trade out of the thing that's expensive.
Yeah, so ratio is at the heart of our conversation today. And the beauty is, I bet half the audience has already checked out because it's not scintillating enough. It's not obvious enough. It's not easy enough. It's not a stock tip, let me go buy 50 shares. You know, it's not actionable in those terms. It's very actionable, but it takes time and it takes a long-term commitment. So I want to describe a trade just as an example, which illustrates how helpful the math is. And again, this solves a demographic problem. It solves the division issue. As I mentioned earlier, this is a task. It's a method. It requires stability. And there's commitment, ideally through decades, not years, even through generations, not just sort of your personal time horizon relating to retirement and whatnot. So let's talk about palladium.
Right. That's in the news anyway, because it's going parabolic.
Since the year 2000, it's up 425%. In the past year, it has pushed up 75%. And in the last 30 days, it's up 27%. You could describe the rise as parabolic. It is. The rate of change marks it as an asset that is now in vulnerable territory. The faster any asset appreciates, you're seeing an audience sort of gather in and push the price up higher on a momentum basis. And you're also getting sooner on that basis to running out of new buying. You have to have new buyers come in to perpetuate that price movement. It's a momentum trend. And so, again, you push higher, and then ultimately it crumbles back.
Well, so explain the math. Okay, platinum, palladium, and why?
Yep. Palladium and platinum are used industrially, predominantly in vehicles. So we're talking catalytic converters, which use the metals. And by using those metals, there's an improvement in emissions. The demand is not likely to disappear. Through time, what we see is the preference for one metal or the other, driven by consumer tolerances for gas prices, fuel consumption efficiency, environmental concerns. So there are times when people don't mind paying for regular gasoline. If it's not too cheap, no worries. And there's times when the preference swings toward diesel because you've got these huge gains in terms of miles per gallon performance, which diesel is hard to beat. Mm-hmm. But there are thresholds where consumers care less. We're in that time frame where there's a lot of people buying regular gasoline engines. Then you've got the auto manufacturers. The auto manufacturers have purchasing managers. They're buying the commodity in advance for production in future vehicles, and they tend to buy large quantities and stockpile. Mm-hmm. The recent run-up in palladium is not purchasing managers stockpiling, but it's speculators doing what speculators do. They're riding the momentum train. You've got these short-term wins, and from our vantage point, this is not negative, but palladium's not compelling as, you know, when you're trading the ratio and you look at the two, this is platinum and palladium, now all of a sudden things are out of whack. The numbers don't translate. They don't make sense anymore.
Well, and I think we should say platinum can be substituted for palladium and vice versa. So, you know, it takes a little bit more palladium than it does platinum. But what we've seen through the years is auto manufacturers will use one for about a decade and then it gets too expensive and then they switch to the other.
Yeah. And again, I think there's also the aspect of preference for diesel versus gasoline, which is also a, you know, a function and a factor. We mentioned VW. VW highlights one of the reasons why diesel is out of favor. Not only is gas cheap and has been for the last 12, 18 months, but you've also had the VW scandal relating to diesel reporting and whatnot. And so there's a stigma that we're working through. And so we've been doing these trades with platinum plating going back a long time. There was a client who engaged with us on this back in 2008. And because we just helped transact some things for him this last week, I think it's a helpful demonstration. So yes, we've been doing this for 5 decades, but if you just wanted to focus on the near term, just to keep it relevant in the present tense, platinum was more than 2 times. Double what it is today, $2,300 an ounce.
Back in 2008.
That's right.
I remember that.
So this is kind of the March time frame. It's bouncing between 2,000 and 2,300. It's $1,000 now, roughly. And because of the excessive ratio then, where platinum was more expensive than palladium, not just in price terms, but again, we're comparing the ratio, we positioned in palladium. Okay. Again, it was the better relative value at the time. The ratio was greater than 4 to 1.
You could get 4 ounces of palladium for 1 ounce of platinum.
Yeah, so exactly. 1 ounce platinum had the same monetary value as over 4 ounces palladium, just to say that differently. You focus on the value side of the equation, and this is what helps sort of drive the decision. The mandate that you're always buying the better value and selling the overvalued asset is what goes into the ratio trade. Mm-hmm. In this case, the initial purchase was palladium. Last week, this client went out of palladium, sold palladium to platinum, and is getting 2.2 ounces of platinum for every ounce of palladium. So let me spell it out a couple of different ways for you, just to make sure the math makes sense. The original purchase of 10 ounces of palladium was in lieu of 1.75 ounces of platinum.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The equivalent value at the time, the ratio at the time, 10 ounces of palladium, about 1.75 ounces of platinum. Same dollars involved for either purchase.
About $4,000 at the time.
Yep.
You could have 1.7 ounces of platinum, or you could have 10 ounces of palladium.
Yeah. Now instead, the palladium is being swapped for 22 ounces of platinum. So in dollar terms, the client shows a better than 5 times dollar gain, 4,000, 5,000. Let's say 5,000, now it's 25,000, just to keep the math simple. 4,000 to 23, I mean, it's
right.
5 times the dollar gain.
But the ounce gain is twice that. It's 11 times.
And this is what we're playing for over the long haul. An 11x gain is better than a 5x gain.
Right.
Would you agree?
Yeah, but that wasn't a quick trade. I mean, that's a dozen years,
that's
right?
12 years.
It's an 11-fold gain in ounces. That's beautiful.
It takes time.
But it takes time. It's the cowboy way.
We get older over the course of a decade.
Right.
Right? And we stay busy doing other things, whatever. But, you know, I mean, that is the patience game, right?
Yeah, so we're talking about— What if that client gets to do that again in 12 years?
Well, right. So 11 times gain, each one of those— 1, 2, 3, 4. That's 100%, right? So that's 1,100%. I mean, we're talking about roughly 1,000% return in a 12-year period. That's kind of intriguing.
That is.
Am I getting that right? So now it's platinum that's the undervalued. And the swing is in that direction, both if we're talking about allocating fresh dollars, it would be to platinum.
Right.
Or swapping ounces for ounces. Over the course of the next decade, between, let's look at the market dynamics, supply constraints, you know, where are you coming from? You're coming from South Africa, you're coming from Russia. I mean, these are your two dominant providers of these metals. So between supply constraints and then the demand dynamics, those metals should again flip to platinum being the premium asset.
Right.
And not palladium. Frankly, I don't think American Express is, you know, stressing this and in, you know, some sort of a business rebranding, planning to rename the platinum card the palladium card.
Right.
Just because palladium is temporarily trading at a higher number. Platinum is more often than not the premium asset through time. So if I venture a guess, and again, this is hypothetical, I'm thinking ahead now. If I venture a guess, this client should be able to convert his 22 ounces of platinum using the ratios again into 60 ounces of palladium on the next value swing. And if just let's say he teaches his kids to do the same, the next move after that, back in the direction of platinum, should be to 105 ounces. So step back from this and now consider that the original difference was 10 versus 2, or 1.75. From what would have been 1.75 ounces to theoretically 105 ounces or more. This is what we hope our client continues with and passes on intergenerationally, this idea of compounding ounces, taking a real asset ballast within a total portfolio structure and not just waiting for the price of gold, silver, platinum, palladium to increase, which is, of course, a no-brainer. Yes, that's on the face of it, adding value.
Well,
but compounding ounces with our clients, that's where the real value is through time.
If you're listening to this and you're going, okay, these numbers are going too quick, there is a report, Dave, that shows this.
How to double your ounces.
How to double your ounces without adding new money. It's just doubling ounces, and or in this case, it was 11-fold. But click the link in the description below or the show notes. You can click there or call us, 800-525-9556. We'll send you the report. But actually, you were talking about value. This is where, hopefully, we as a firm add value too, Dave. We've been through these things, experience over and over and over. I remember this client and I remember the discussion over and over and over, but I remember with him especially, he wasn't really wanting to buy palladium. He just looked at platinum's price at the time and he said, it's too high. I'm going to buy palladium, which is a sister metal.
This is one of the key distinctions between what we do and what we've done for almost 50 years and what many of our competitors do. They can sell a product at a price. I look at our team of advisors and I think the value added, this is really where separates the, you know, as they used to say, separates the men from the boys, separates the professionals from the amateurs. In this sense, we're the professionals.
Well, and there's times you don't make the swap. It's not just an algorithm. There are times when you purposely don't make the swap because there's other extenuating circumstances that only history would know. And that is the difference between clicking online and just buying your gold on the internet from somebody you don't know versus, you know, handholding.
Platinum and palladium, that's one example. The same focus on gold and silver reveals a comparable opportunity to compound ounces with that part of your metals portfolio. A metals portfolio should be proportioned and split up in a couple of different ways.
And that doesn't usually take as long. We talked about a 12-year cycle, 9 to 12 years for platinum and palladium. Silver, gold, you can make a couple of those in a decade usually.
And again, there's talkers and doers in this world. And most people in our industry, they're talkers at best. They haven't been around and they haven't taken advantage of these cycles. So frankly, sometimes the cycles... The cycles can be discouraging if you focus on the dollars involved and not the ounces.
The U.S. dollar, down.
Yeah, think about this. The client who bought palladium in 2008 instead of platinum still watched the commodity price fall in half. In 2009, palladium dropped by more than 50%. You can say, I made a terrible mistake.
Didn't the ratio get better, though, between platinum and palladium same time?
Right. So good news, bad news. The ratio improved, confirming the right choice in that value proposition, even as the nominal price appeared unhelpful, right? So this is, again, it just depends on how you want to play this. But over the long term, we've seen this sort of add value.
Well, go back to gold and silver then, because that's probably more familiar to the people who are listening.
I'm going to give you a three-generation proposition, right? Okay. So this is back to gold and silver instead of the platinum group metals. Don is my father, David, myself, Declan, my oldest son. This is hypothetical. Don starts with 10 ounces of gold, okay? 10 ounces. We're not talking about a king's ransom. We're talking about a modest number of ounces of gold.
Mm-hmm.
10 ounces of gold over a 40-year period. 40 years is a long time. He plays the ratio three times, trading not at ideal intervals, right? Because this ratio will be as high as 100 and as low as 15.
Yeah, so don't plan on perfection. Just try to do it within the range.
I'm going to say between 70 on the high side, not 100, between 70 and 35 on the low side. So again, going from gold to silver and back to gold, that is one time. That's a round trip.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying he's going to repeat that two more times. When he passes the baton to me, he's gone from 10 ounces of gold to 80 ounces of gold.
Just by doing three round trips, gold to silver, back to gold.
That's right.
Yeah.
I take on the project and do three trades at the same ratio intervals over my 40-year period and pass along the baton. This time it's 640 ounces of gold to my son. Mm. Declan comes along and repeats the trading in and out three times. This is, again, this happens more frequently than three times in 40 years, right?
Right.
But I want to,
you're trying to be
reasonable expectations. Yeah. And actually the numbers are unbelievable. But Declan comes along and repeats the trading in and out three times, boosts the family position to 5,120 ounces. Mm. So in the first generation, there is an eightfold increase over 40 years. Yeah, okay, fine. That's great, whatever. But building on that, I bring it to a 64-fold increase from the original 10 ounces to 640 ounces total. Mm-hmm. And in the third generation, multiplying, not dividing wealth, bumps the total return to 512-fold from the original 10 ounces to 5,120 ounces.
Well, and a good way to check to see if something makes sense is to try to explain it to a kid. And I've watched you. You have explained this to kids and they get it.
I've played this math out on a whiteboard for dozens of kids. Every one of them gets it. It's a game of multiply. And make money a game, not an obsession. Don't define your significance by it, but see what can be done with it. Define it as a useful tool, something to be stewarded from one generation to the next. This is where this game becomes an expression of intergenerational stewardship. Mm-hmm. If you're adding kids, grandkids, great-grandkids to the mix, the ordinary math for money is terminal math. You're going, it's going to get used up. It's going away. It's going to be divided into, subsected into nothing, right? People inherit, typically they spend. We've worked with 60,000 people. Why do we know anything about this? Because we've seen so many people inherit money, and this is what happens.
Right.
They typically spend, they dissipate, and other than a few short-term lifestyle improvements, which I'm not criticizing, but there's really nothing to show for an earlier generation's efforts than a few short-term lifestyle improvements. It's amazing to me the number of depreciating assets that get purchased. There's no method, there's no process, there's no view of the future which flips the division function to multiplication.
Well, and just as a reminder, again, call for the report if you want it, 800-525-9556, or just go online, click in the show notes, and get the Double Your Ounces report. That won't give a full explanation, but it'll get you started.
Right. Well, we're talking about the same math as it applies to the Dow and gold ratio.
Right. You're not eliminating the stock market.
No,
in this.
Not at all.
It's just the stock market at this point is too high based on ratios, right?
Exactly. So we're talking about multiple themes to have in play within a total portfolio where you own paper assets, you own real things. And so stocks definitely factor in here too. People think the stock market has performed well in recent years. And I'll sound like a crazy man to say that's debatable. But the math says that it is debatable. 43-1 was the ratio, that is the Dow compared to gold in the year 2000. Now it's at 18.
Yeah.
Right? So the Dow in real money terms, the Dow in gold terms is down more than 50% over the past 20 years.
Okay. So Dave, you were a stockbroker. The Dow was your life 20 years ago. Okay. And you saw this ratio. You made a shift yourself.
Yeah. So, I mean, and again, this is difficult for people to conceive of because in dollar terms, we've gone from 12,000 points on the Dow to 29,000 points on the Dow, and that appears to be a great gain. Okay, fine. But in real money terms, you're down 50%. Counterintuitive, but the biggest winner was not equities. Equity indexes, that is. You could find an individual company that stands out here or there, but the ratio typically swings from the low single digits into the 20s, even the 30s, and as we saw in year 2000, the 40s.
Okay, let me just insert here for the person who's catching up. This is taking the Dow and dividing it by the price of an ounce of gold. How many ounces of gold is the Dow worth today?
18.8 is the number today. And over a 20-year period, sometimes maybe even a little bit longer than 20 years, you'll see that ratio swing by 20 points in either direction. Hmm. And what is this really? I mean, so step back from the math. This is the gradual expression of greed and fear in the marketplace, and it's being expressed in the price of assets that are owned when one of those themes, either greed or fear, is dominant. What does that mean? In real terms, the agnostic investor gets to multiply a financial footprint 20 times on one side of the trade, potentially 20 times on the other side of the trade as well. So it's just fascinating to me that people begin to nitpick a 5% return, a 10% return, a 12% return. Are you keeping up with the Joneses? How do you compare to the guy you play golf with? You know, when you're managing money over decades and you pay attention to cost basis, those numbers become a little absurd.
Right. Well, and Dave, we talked last week about, you ask a person what they're invested in right now, and they'll say, well, a 2032 fund or a 2035 fund.
Or 1732 fund, as you said last year. Referencing the
bubble. But,
yeah, exactly.
But the point is, those who are passively investing their money right now, just putting it over in Vanguard, they're not understanding what you just now talked about, cost basis.
Right.
Cost basis. If something's too high, don't buy it. If something's too low and it has real value, buy it. That's what Buffett does. People try to imitate Buffett. That's what Buffett does. He buys the cheap stuff that he knows should be more expensive.
I went skiing with a gentleman in Telluride. This was a couple years back, and his father had been the lead counsel for Phillips Petroleum. Became ConocoPhillips. And in the 1920s and 30s, he was buying shares in what would become ExxonMobil for $1.50, $2 a share. Now, you look at the dividend of ExxonMobil today, and it's multiples of his cost basis. Mm. They've maintained that cost basis as a company, as a family, rather, through all these decades. And the dividend income equals more than 100% of their original cost basis. So does cost basis matter? Yeah. And you said that last week. Cost basis matters. Starting on the right side of a trade, now thinking about cost basis and ratio trades, it's basically establishing a position focused on value. What's next? The next step is selling out of an overvalued asset once they've appreciated, moving to undervalued assets. For the Dow Gold ratio, you're talking about a 3-to-1. By the way, when you're doing ratio trades and things like this, it's not as if you're doing with 100% of your money. It's not an all or nothing bet,
right?
Correct? I mean, the incremental migration towards one asset class is also an incremental migration away. And you may retain some percentage permanently as a part of this sort of permanent family wealth.
Even the client last week, okay, going from palladium to platinum, he didn't do everything. He did half.
Okay.
And he's going to watch and he'll do more later.
Well, so again, for the Dow Gold ratio, 3-to-1, that ratio is, in my view, a conservative target number for this cycle.
And we're at what, 18 now?
18.
Roughly?
Simple math, 6x multiplier in terms of the financial footprint you can gain engaging the Dow Gold ratio. Moving out of ounces, not all of your ounces, into shares, at that point, it has the benefit of increasing your financial footprint considerably.
Well, and that can happen either way. The stock market could come down and gold could come up, or the stock market could go up and gold could go up more. Whatever the case is, that ratio, it will narrow.
Right. So you mentioned this is something I've done. I did choose a very healthy gold allocation at about a 40-to-1 on the ratio.
20 years ago.
Yeah. So you're talking $300 gold. That's a little better than a double. So we've gone from a 40-to-1 ratio to now 18-to-1.
Again, right. So in dollars, you actually did better in dollars. The ratio hasn't really benefited you fully yet.
Well, and this is what's deceiving. In dollar terms, it looks better. Going from $300 gold to $1,500 gold, that's great, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, those numbers are going to get flipped to the other side when the ratio math is at an inflection point. So let me just talk to that. In terms of the shares that I could own now if I moved into stocks, again, I've doubled, right? Mm-hmm. I could own twice the amount that I could 20 years ago.
What if we were at 10-to-1 instead of 18-to-1?
At a 10-to-1 ratio, that is, again, going from 40 down to 10, it's a quadrupling of the shares.
So let's do it again. 5-to-1.
That's an 8x multiplier in terms of my financial footprint.
And you're shooting for 3, 2, or 1-to-1, right?
Yeah. A 3-to-1 ratio is a 13x multiplier in terms of my financial footprint. And a 1-to-1 is obviously I start at 40. That's a 40x multiplier. Before we even go the other direction, and as the ratio increases, swap out of financial assets back into gold.
Hmm.
So the ugly, we talked about the good and the bad and the ugly. I think the ugly is really what is happening to the minds of people such that they think only about short-term gains.
Yeah.
This year's returns, this quarter's returns. We get a monthly statement as a reflection of real progress. only it's not real progress. And they're not employing any process to their investments. It's really just a speculative game.
Well, you talked about the book Deep Work. Cal Newport talks about deliberate practice. Have a deliberate practice. What is it that we're doing deliberately? And your practice in investing, there's a deliberate practice sometimes of just laying in wait. You buy something of value and you wait, like this investor, you wait 12 years and get an 11-fold return, but then make the move. But that's a disciplined practice.
Well, and part of this is, I think anyone who's been around the block knows that you make money on the purchase. You buy it right, right? It's not just a question of buying any asset and being patient for an infinite amount of time. You buy the asset right. You buy an asset cheap enough and you'll make money. And so this is where, again, if you ignore valuation metrics, you're in trouble, right? Here's where the ugly is. We've got the price to sales ratio, which today is the highest it's been in U.S. stock market history.
Right. Which price the stock sales, market is too high.
Highest in U.S. market history. There's other metrics which come close, but the ugly is ignorance. The ugly is selfishness. The ugly is short-termism. It's a lack of vision. It's a blind belief by the lemmings of our day that wisdom is expressed by the mass movement of people and money all around them. And they just need to get on board. Again, that issue of fear of missing out. Everybody must be moving towards something great. The ugly, frankly, is what happens next as a result of the cultural deformation that we're witness to. Hmm. And it's caused in large measure by the proliferation of what we talked about earlier, the bad. Why are so many people on this bandwagon? Why do they lack vision? Why have they become short-term in their thinking? Why do they not care about long-term returns? It's just about what you've done for me. Like, it's growth at any cost, right? Which we've done growth at any cost through the debt markets. And so the bad, the debt, we are willing to go there. We're willing to proliferate the bad, even if that means enslaving our children, our grandchildren, under a burden of debt.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. And if you'd like that report, give us a call, 800-525-9556. Ask for the report on how to double your ounces.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.